Jennifer Egan won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for her novel A Visit from the Goon Squad. Her new novel, Manhattan Beach, is set in the shipyards and nightclubs of 1940s Brooklyn. And Jennifer Egan is with me to tell me more. In fact, it starts a little bit before the 40s and the 30s when we meet the Kerrigan family, who are central to the whole novel. Give us the setup of that family, Jennifer.
Well, Eddie Kerrigan is an Irish-American guy who actually moved from Ireland to America, grew up in an orphanage in the Bronx, and has ended up in the kind of on the Irish waterfront, so the West Side docks in Manhattan. Anna is his daughter, who later grows up to work in the Brooklyn Navy Yard and is one of our protagonists. And she has a younger sister named Lydia, who's been severely impaired at birth. And Eddie finds that very, very hard to deal with. And that has created a bit of a wedge between him and his wife, the girl's mother, who is very fiercely devoted to her care and frustrated with Eddie over the fact that he doesn't really express much love for this compromised daughter.
The Kerrigan family experience real difficulties when Eddie literally just walks out the door one day and doesn't come back. When did you discover that Eddie was going to do that? And how important was it then about creating some sort of momentum to hold us right the way through the book?
I think I knew from the beginning that he was going to disappear. And the question is, what happens then? You know, the family is left without a breadwinner. And pretty soon, Anna is working at the Brooklyn Navy Yard to help support the family, because now the mother is caring on her own for this impaired child.
And another very important character then is Dexter Stiles, who we will meet later on after Eddie has disappeared, but we meet him quite early as well when Eddie goes to him because he needs help with Lydia.
Yes, I mean, he's what's called a bagman on the working for the union, meaning essentially that he gives and receives bribes, and he's not being paid very well for that. So he does something a bit risky, which is forms an alliance with a boss from what is known as the syndicate, which is a more Italian branch of organized crime. And he does this unbeknownst to his fellow longshoremen union friends on the docks. And he brings Anna with him because she is sort of his companion, the one bright spot in his family life, which is so troubled because of his compromised daughter, Lydia.
This is a pretty corrupt world that Eddie has found himself in. But there's an interesting part to his background, and indeed his wife's background, which is the whole theatrical side of life. What flavor did that bring to the book for you?
Well, in a way, I mean, Eddie is drawn to it in a way for the same reason that his wife was, which is it's this world in which people come from all over to make their way in New York. And for Eddie, it was a way out of the Bronx orphanage where he grew up, along with a lot of other kids whose families either didn't want them or had died. And the big disappointment in his life is that he ended up getting involved. He made some money and was investing in the stock market and hoping to become a stockbroker, and then lost everything in the crash. His wife was still dancing at that point with the Follies. And there's a lot of really fun history about all of that. I mean, it was great reading, and it's a really kind of sparkly moment in the history of New York theater, certainly.
But you bring us to, certainly when we move a little bit further into the book and we get into wartime, we're going to darker places. But just to stick briefly with Dexter. Dexter has an Italian, possibly Polish side to him as well, but he wants to negotiate and associate with the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. He wants to be waspish.
Yes, and he's actually married into a clan like that. And he's an interesting figure that really in some ways grew out of my research, because he's part the syndicate. Organized crime, as we know it, became organized to move and sell liquor during Prohibition in America. But from 1919 to 1933, alcohol was illegal. It's sort of hard to believe. So the figure of the gangster became socially acceptable in a way that's a little bit hard for us to imagine. But, you know, they were welcomed because they were bringing the booze. And so Dexter Stiles is a kind of classic American type in that he's reached for this sort of life as a way to get upward mobility, very like Gatsby, who, of course, was a bootlegger in the Fitzgerald novel. And then he makes the really, I guess it's a mistake, but it's one we can all identify with, of wanting to go completely legitimate and leave that rather murky and violent past behind him. And that proves to be very hard to do.
But the real, I suppose, the heart of the book is this naval yard and that whole background and how Anna becomes involved in, of all things, diving.
Yes. Well, one thing I hadn't realized until I started learning about the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was the largest builder and repairer of Allied ships in the world, I should mention, employing 70,000 people at the height of the war, is that an important part of ship repair is deep sea diving. I mean, it's the divers who look at the ships from underneath and patch them and do all kinds of things without the ship having to go into dry dock. And so Anna, and it's dangerous work, and the pay was higher, therefore, and they used a lot of civilians to do it. I was very excited by the idea of learning more about this. I've never even scuba dived. So Anna, my protagonist, decides that she wants to be a diver, and it is not a world that's very welcoming to women. In fact, the whole Navy Yard was like that initially, but they desperately needed women to do industrial work, just as they did here, and they had a whole propaganda campaign of Rosie the Riveter to persuade women that they should do work they'd been told all their lives they couldn't do. So Anna does become a diver, is definitely not welcomed into that world, nor treated very well at first, but she's pretty fearless and pretty determined.
Did I read, why do you say you haven't even scuba dived, did I read, though, that you actually managed to wear at least the helmet of one of these very heavy diving suits?
I wore the whole thing.
The whole thing.
I fell in with some Army diving veterans who have a very tight-knit organization, and they meet every other year for a reunion. One of the things they offer to their members is the possibility of wearing the old Mark V, which is the diving suit anyone would conjure. It's the big spherical helmet and the lead belt and the big boots. And they can actually dive in it, in tanks. And interestingly, this equipment was current into the 1960s. So it really was worn for more than half a century. So even people who dove during the Vietnam War would still have worn the Mark V. So anyway, I got dressed in it. They dressed me in it. It doesn't make sense to say I got dressed in it because it's almost like having a machine assembled around you that the helmet screws onto the collar, and it does weigh 200 pounds, which is one of those notions that you can think, oh, that would be really uncomfortable, but it's really quite different to actually wear it.
But it was within that group, I think, and somebody within that group who had a history, that you found the inspiration for Anna, a real life woman, a Russian woman.
At the same reunion where I wore the Mark V, I interviewed a man named Jim Kennedy, who had dived during World War II in Cherbourg, helping to clear out the harbor with the U.S. Army. And I spoke to him, and I said, did you ever encounter a woman in your years of diving? And he said, once, in Cherbourg, and she was Russian, which, of course, we know that the Russian women did everything. I mean, they flew planes, they were doctors. So I was very intrigued by the idea of this Russian diver, and I liked the thought that maybe there was more of a story there than Jim Kennedy was telling me in front of all of his diving friends. So we had a plan to speak on the phone a couple of months later, but he very suddenly passed away. He was in his 80s. So we never had that conversation. So I guess I took it from there.
Did you find any evidence that an American woman might have been a diver during the war?
I think it's extremely unlikely. But the interesting thing about the war and about writing about that time is that in some way, everything was turning upside down. People were leaving their homes. Women and African Americans were being not only allowed to do work they hadn't done before, but pretty much begged to do it because people needed talent and they needed manpower and woman power. So it was a great moment to take liberties like putting a woman underwater when it's probable that no one did it, but who knows?
Which in part would probably answer my next question. This is the first time that you have written historical fiction or historic fiction. The whole idea, the question that always comes up is, what do you do with the facts and what do you do? Where does the fiction begin? Where does the fact end? Was that important to you, or was it actually more about getting the atmosphere of what was happening at that time rather than factually representing what was going on?
The facts were extremely important to me. I only felt comfortable making my own leaps if I knew the facts. I begin writing without a sense of the story or the characters. I just start with atmosphere and sort of the spheres and the worlds of the book. So in the case of this, that meant the Brooklyn Navy Yard, organized crime, deep sea diving, and the merchant marine. submarine, all realms about which I knew absolutely nothing. So for about 5 years while I was working on other books, I researched these things in a kind of desultory way, like going on the diving reunion. And then when I started writing, that was really the first time that I had any idea what my actual story would be. And then I had much more targeted research than I needed to do. Sometimes ideas came from the research. For example, I was part of an oral history project in which I interviewed a number of women who worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. They were in their 80s, and this would have been before 2010. Some of their stories, in a certain way, became part of my own memory, and I was able to draw on those in inventing my own character, just because I had been listening to this stuff for years by then.
And what strikes me as we come to the end of Manhattan Beach, there are fragments here that can continue on. There are aspects of this Kerrigan family story that have a possibility of being going into further generations. Is that part of the plan?
I would love it if I could do that, in part because writing about the war, about the freedoms that women experienced during the war and African Americans, and then the way in which a lot of those freedoms were taken away, and the way that so much industry and technology moved to the West Coast of America because of the war, you know, all of this comes to bear in the 1960s. And I'm just curious to sort of follow all of that. It just feels like the natural next step. And now we're back in my lifetime, but I feel like I'm sort of understanding why events I witnessed occurred for the first time.
Jennifer Egan has been talking about her latest novel, Manhattan Beach, which is published by Corsair.